Outside the Captain's Guild, the commander walked Gunnar along the concourse in the direction of the slideways.
You had a visitor this morning you didn't tell us about.
Even though Gunnar understood that Tavard was pretending to be antagonistic, he could still feel his neck getting hot.
I don't see why I should tell you about every possible customer who comes by. And you were asking about Sarah Suiza.
I told you we were interested in possible mutineers and pirates, and you sat there and didn't say one word about this man.
The commander pulled out a flat pick of the man who'd been at the ship that morning.
He's a former commander in fleet, a mutineer, the very sort of man I talked to you about.
I'm not your spy. Why didn't you show me that picture before and ask if I'd seen him?
Would you have answered?
Of course. What kind of an idiot do you think I am?
Idiot enough not to tell me about this man when he came by, and now he's escaped.
He's not on the station?
No. If you'd only used your head, we might have caught him. I want to come check out your office area, see if he left any clues.
All right. But I can tell you he didn't. He walked in, wanted passage, and we didn't have enough cabins and weren't fast enough. Yes, it's true he wanted me to take a yellow route, but old fortune's not mine to risk. And he didn't want to wait while I asked the company.
Did he say where he was going?
No. He said he wanted passage to Millicent.
Well, I hope you'll act more responsibly next time. And encourage other captains to do the same. We don't want you people being hijacked.
In the Fortune's dockside office, the commander handed Gunnar a data cube.
Good acting, Captain. Now, that really is a mutineer, and his name really is Taylor, and we do consider him extremely dangerous. We don't know if he left anyone behind to spy on this station. I wouldn't be surprised if he did. He did get away, in a yacht leased by one of the Seated families.
What? The families are in league with the mutineers?
Not all of them. But the mutineers, some of them, have tried to make contact with the families they worked for before Fleet was organized. And a disaffected family member, looking for some muscle to impose on the rest of his family, would make exactly the right employer. They have their quarrels, same as anyone else.
So this was... who? One of the Consulines?
Captain, this is not something you need to know, but it wasn't a Consuline.
And you don't know where this person wanted to go?
No, or where the mutineers wanted to go. This man may have bought his way into a mysterious death. I wouldn't trust my life to these cutthroats.
I hope, Commander, that if my routes are taking me into dangerous territory, you'll let me know.
Yes, you may be at special risk, since he knows you've seen his face. I'm hoping that this evening's little charade convinced anyone he left on guard. But once you're in space again, what's your route?
It depends. I told the Fathers that we'd be delayed here because of the troop, as we have been. And if Bethia wants to be married here, we might well be delayed longer. Tarakian Princess is bound this way. If she arrives before we leave, we may switch routes. I'd head out towards Xavier, Rotterdam, Corian, and that loop.
I'd recommend that. Now, if we could only figure out for sure where that yacht is going. They told the leasing company one thing, which almost certainly isn't true. But there's a lot of space in the Familias, if they even stay in the Familias.
Basil, when Gunnar went aboard, wanted to know all about Bethia. Gunnar put him off by telling him about the commander.
He interrupted us. Wanted to talk about that fellow who came this morning.
A criminal?
A mutineer. Very dangerous, he says. And worst of all, he got away. He's already off the station.
That's good.
Is it? That commander says he has a warship somewhere. Probably somewhere along that yellow route to Millicent. On top of that, he's linked up with a rogue family member, someone rich enough to walk in and hire a fully stocked yacht at the drop of a hat. They don't know where he's gone, but they know he has money enough at his command as long as this family member is with him.
So, do they think he caught on to us?
He doesn't know. He suspects the man might have left a spy here on the station, and that he might be watching us. We played quite a little drama for any watchers, with me as the selfish captain who had been stupid enough not to tell him about this mutineer earlier.
But what about Bethia?
She'll call before they leave, she said, probably tomorrow.
You're blushing, Gunnar.
Well, I do like her, Baz. You're right about that. But there's a lot to think about.
You're not getting any younger.
I'm not doddering along with one foot in the grave either. I don't have to rush into things.
But the memory that he had done just that made him grin. Basil gave him a suspicious look.
What? What did you say to her?
Basil, go to bed. I am.
Brun Meager sank into the worn tapestry upholstery of the couch in the Mahoney's living room.
Keval, are you sure this is all right? You've only just gotten the house back.
Stepan suggested it. I see you've got your father's stick.
Bruin leaned it against the couch.
So I have. Do you, does anyone, have the slightest idea what was going on and who did it?
The present idea is that Hollis wanted to talk to you in private, he and your cousin Kel. There's no real evidence except that Hollis found you at dinner and told you he'd been to the house looking for you and found police there. That didn't happen. My guess would be that he wasn't actually planning to kill you, just trying to bully you into doing something he wanted.
He wanted to go to Cerealis, he said. I can't imagine why.
To find out what your mother found?
Possibly. If he thought it was your mother's evidence that landed him in trouble.
Has anyone located him?
No, he didn't go up on a scheduled shuttle, but you know there are other ways. Does he own a shuttle?
He might have taken the family one.
Not the one at Appledale, we checked on that. But with the Grand Council meeting coming up, there are family shuttles of all sizes coming and going. He might have caught a ride with someone. We're trying to find out. And of course, he may not have tried to get off-world at all. He could be on his way back to his own place or somewhere else.
And there are a few more things for the police to do than chase one suspect, I'll bet.
Yes. Brun, we've made up the spare bedroom for you and Kate. Stepan's having his senior security staff check over the townhouse. He expects you can move back in tomorrow morning. We're covered, of course.
Brun felt both very tired and very alert.
Of course.
Have you told Kate about the meeting today?
No. I wasn't planning to.
Stepan said it wouldn't hurt, and it might take the strain off you, not to be keeping more secrets than you have to.
Keval turned to Kate.
Stepan's head of our sept, the Barracliffs, and he asked Brun to become his designated heir.
The sept? I've never quite understood. Families, I understand. Is this like a sort of super family of families?
Yes, in a way.
Well, quite a step up then.
You'll like this. The one thing I had to do was to agree not to be rejuved.
My.
Yes. Power versus longevity. Take your pick. And I'm being dropped in at the deep end. He wants me to address the Grand Council formally at the next meeting. So I think I'd better toddle off to bed and get my beauty sleep.
Brun woke with a start in the unfamiliar bed. She could just make out the green and cream stripes of the wallpaper.
What? Yes?
It's me. Can you come out?
Brun looked at the time. She could have used another hour's sleep, but she was, after all, wide awake.
Coming.
She wrapped the borrowed robe around her and went out to find Keval waiting for her in his study.
We just heard. Hollis rented a yacht from All Systems Leasing yesterday. He's with a mutineer commander, and apparently rented the yacht bare. Probably crewed by fleet personnel, in other words. They requested and got a fast transit exit route and went into jump 2 hours ago.
Did they say where they were going?
Hollis told All Systems, Burkholt and Celeste, but the same mutineer had tried to get passage on a civilian ship to Millicent. I think the question at this point is, who's in command of that yacht?
Kate appeared in the doorway.
Oh, they don't even get up this early on ranches. Oh, found Harless, did they?
And lost him. Case of the right hand not having told the left what was going on.
He explained what they knew.
Oh, it doesn't make sense.
What doesn't?
The timing. He was at the restaurant when we were eating dinner. What time was that?
I don't know. It wasn't late. 1900, maybe?
And the yacht left the station at 22:30. So he must have run for a shuttle and then gone immediately.
Yes, that makes sense.
Except that he leased the yacht earlier. He'd had to have been on the station, then come down to the surface, then gone back up. Why? Is that even possible?
With good private shuttles, of course.
He came down to pick you up. He arranged to hire the ship, he leased the shuttle, and while the ship was being provisioned, he came down to get you.
He was going to take her away? Where?
Brun felt a chill that struck through her like a spear of ice. Had she really come so close to another captivity? But her mind went on working.
I don't want to know. Cerealis. If he took me to Cerealis, the people there would think it was me. I mean, they'd think it was all right at first, and then...
A hostage. Against your sept. Certainly against anything the people on Cerealis might do. And, Brunn, you have the family codes for the communications and data storage systems on Cerealis, don't you?
Yes, of course. Everything but Mother's private ciphers.
Would he know about hers? About your not having them?
Brunn felt a wave of panic and shoved it down.
I don't know.
Our files on him are at Appledale. We didn't bring them into town. Didn't see a reason to. He was detained, we thought.
Gentleman's detention. He wore a scan bracelet. His attorneys argued that he wasn't going to bolt, and he posted a huge bond. Anyway, he claimed to have a toothache. Apparently, his dentist took the bracelet off for him early yesterday morning. Nobody realized he'd slipped away for hours. The dentist claimed he had an emergency ahead of Hollis, and the bracelet returned a signal. The dentist's now in detention himself. They found the bracelet tucked under the cushion of one of his chairs.
Did Hollis go to Appledale?
No, we've called out there. No intrusion.
He has the family codes.
What?
Hollis. He has the family codes. Some of them anyway, the general ones, I'm sure. Unless Mother changed them when she left, but she would have thought that he was in detention. No reason to change them. And nobody's there.
The staff are. The others...
No family. No one who can change the codes and lock him out.
If that's where he's going, with a fleet warship, just changing the codes wouldn't help.
I'll bet that's how they got in the first place.
Kevil looked blank, and so did George.
Who got in? When?
Lupescu and his hunters. I'll bet it was Harless or my cousin Kel.
You could be right. Your father never did figure out why that fellow who was station master of the Pine Cone let him in. If Harless had pressured him, it makes more sense.
But now we have to stop him getting there. I'll have to go.
Brunn, you can't. You have to be here.
But Kevil, we can't just let him go in there and terrorize people.
What could you do if you were there?
Warn them, try to help them.
But she knew it would be futile. She wasn't a battle group of fleet ships all in herself. She had to give that up and do what she could for the Familius as a whole. She could warn them, that was all. Brunn suspected that fleet would not do anything, but she had to make the attempt. Sure enough, after taking her report, the Admiral Minor on the screen shook her head.
I'm sorry, Sarah, but in the present situation, we can't detach troops to protect one world.
One rich family's playground world was the implication. After the expense of her rescue, Brunn knew she could not ask Fleet for favors.
I understand that, but you needed to know that we suspect one of the mutineer ships, or maybe more, is headed there.
Yes, I understand that, but that's a fairly isolated world with a small population. Better they should go there than attack a more populous planet. It has no manufacturing capacity, has it?
No, only light industry.
It would take them 5 years to build up a shipyard capable of producing FTL ships, and that's with stolen parts, not from scratch. That gives us time to cut them off. I doubt very much they have the resources to mount a proper system-wide defense. In the meantime, we have urgent concerns elsewhere. As soon as possible, we'll go get them.
I've already warned the population that Hollis may be coming with an armed ship. I don't want to interfere with your dispositions, but may I at least tell them you won't be coming?
Of course, Sarah. In fact, if the mutineers go there and find that out, perhaps they'll stay in what they think is a safe haven until we get there. Quite frankly, Sarah, we have no resources that could reach Cerealis before the mutineers can, if you're right about when they might have started.
Brunn wanted to rage, to kick desks and stamp the polished floor and scream, but that wasn't the way to get things done, not now.
Thank you. Do you have any idea what force of ships that man Taylor might have?
I'm sorry, Sarah. I don't have that information.
After Miranda and Cecilia left, Cerealis subsided into summer somnolence, with opening day a safe 100 or more days away. Not that its inhabitants were idle, not on an agricultural and recreational world. Cerealis fed itself and the guests, who descended on it yearly. The early crops of grain were in. The first cutting of hay lay open to the sun, drying before baling. Truck farms were in full production, and so were the food processing facilities that took the surplus and preserved it for the season. For most of the planet's population, life went on as usual. The schools and stores and other services for the locals didn't change much with the activities of the owners. Whenever family members weren't in residence, the big house went to a skeleton staff except for maintenance. Stables and gardens, of course, were fully staffed year-round. Horses and roses needed constant care. Grooms and gardeners both preferred the quiet seasons. System defense at Cerealis had been minimal for over a century. There was the communications ansible, by which the family alerted the system to their arrival. The landing fields at the main residence and hospitality bay had long scan capability, but system defense and traffic control was handled mostly by the station master at the largest orbital station. All three orbital stations had long scan, and there were a few batteries of anti-ship missiles from the old days, which no one had tested in at least 5 years. Brunn's first Ansible message set off a flurry of activity. There were not enough shuttles and ships within the system to evacuate everyone from the surface. Cerealis' population was small only by comparison with more developed worlds. They had no weapons that would stand up to a military invasion, and Brunn had not been able to say how many ships might show up. She had been able to get Fleet to transmit the specs of various kinds, so they'd have a clue. Gunnar heard nothing from Bethia the next morning, or afternoon.
Did she change her mind? Is she trying to think of a way to let me down easily?
He immersed himself in a study of the shipping figures for a colony to whom Tarakian and Sons was thinking of offering regular service.
Captain Tarakian, how may I help you?
Gunnar, it's done. I'm still at the hotel and I'm really too tired to move tonight. But I'd like to have dinner. Would you mind coming here?
Gunnar dragged his mind away from the profitability analysis of the colony.
Of course not. How formal?
Not very.
Bethia looked very tired, almost wan, in fact. Gunnar wondered if the execrable Doogie had been nagging at her, and felt a strong urge to hunt Doogie up and push his face in.
Are you up to this?
Yes. Don't be fooled by theatrics, Gunnar. I came up with something.
Bethia paused over her salad.
The problem was money. It usually is in theater. Money or jealousy or both. In this case, both.
They owed you?
They owe both of us. They still haven't paid for the passage beyond the first segment. And when we founded the company, the four of us, Merle, Dion, Saren, and I, all contributed equal shares. Merle died 5 years ago, the most ravishing tenor you ever heard, and it was just a stupid traffic accident. Dion got an offer from his home world's most prestigious school of arts a year later, and we bought out his share. We, being Saren, who's our set and costume designer, and me, well, we were short two males, and Saren and I decided to look for more partners. What we really wanted was another good male lead and a business manager. But the people you want don't necessarily have the money when they're available. Usually, in fact.
So?
So, Lisa, already in the company, wanted to buy in. She had the money, an inheritance, she said. We couldn't reasonably refuse. Doogie was working for Greenfield Players. He pulled them out of a financial hole, and he said he wanted to travel. We still didn't have enough capital. So we talked to the rest of the troop, and most of them scraped up enough to buy a share when we restructured.
Is it equal shares now?
No, the way it was. Saren and I each had four, and everyone else had one. I thought it was fair, as long as we were all together. But when I leave, I'll want to take out my shares in cash, and they won't want to pay it.
What did you do?
I went to a clinic and came back looking the way I look now, and explained I'd had a shock.
A shock?
Yes. I reminded Lisa that she'd been saying my voice was not what it had been. I could have smacked her for smirking at me, and that I hadn't wanted to tell them where I was going ahead of time. And the doctors had found a problem, that I was going to have to give up singing and have surgery. And it might never be as good after. That it would be months. It was something difficult which Regen wouldn't fix.
Is that true? When Brun Meager's voice was lost, it...
Gunnar, what Lisa and Doogie know about medicine would fit in your eye. They want to believe I'm over the hill, that my voice is going. They ate this up like whipped cream with honey in it. I said I decided to leave the troop and wanted to buy out my shares. That's when the haggling started. But since I was leaving for reasons of sickness, I had the high ground.
Did you?
Gunnar, there's truth and truth. I've known since before Lisa started carping at me that my voice isn't as good as it was. I've pushed it to the limit in some of the theaters we've played. It's time and past time for me to quit. This is a reason they can accept and still fork over my share. If I told them it was to marry you, they'd say, oh, he's a rich trader and you don't need the money.
I'm not shocked, Bethia. We traders know about creative explanations.
Good. I'd hate to have burned all my bridges and then found I'd alienated you.
What about a wedding? Do we have to wait until they go away?
No. They saw us on the ship. They know I think you're a fine man and that you admired me. Lisa even had the gall to suggest that perhaps I should console myself with the nice Captain Tarakian, if he didn't mind the fact I wasn't the same offstage as on.
So, this dinner...
Let's them think I'm working their suggestion. In the meantime, I have the bank draft.
You are a wicked woman, Betharnia. You might have been a trader born.
My grandparents were in a minor way, if you count wholesalers in kitchenware and restaurant supply.
So, what about a wedding?
There are some I'd like to invite, including Saren. We've known each other 15 years, which means there's no way to exclude the others without causing trouble.
Fine with me. At this point, we might as well wait for the princess to come in.
Gunnar explained the crisscross of routes.
She's in system now. It will make the fathers happier if we have another Tarakian witness. What kind of wedding party do you want?
They dove into wedding planning. When Gunnar came back to the ship that night, Basil looked at his face.
Did you ask her?
Yes, cuz, I did. And she accepted, too. We'll have the wedding when Princess gets here.
I don't suppose she's brought much dowry. Not that it matters, really.
As a matter of fact, she has. Or rather, she has some money of her own.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I didn't expect her to turn it over or anything.
That's good, because she won't. She's investing it.
I'll trust you, Gunnar, to find a second wife who is beautiful, talented, and rich.
The militia captain from Hospitality Bay glared at the militia captain from the home village on Cerealis.
She said we're on our own. Fleets can't come, and we sure can't fight off an invasion. My men know what to do with drunks, thieves, and stupid younglings who think it's funny to cut the nets of fishing boats, not names in battle armor.
So what are you saying? We should all take to the woods? Or just stand around to be beaten up or shot?
No, but I can't see wasting any time on fancy stuff, pictures and books and that.
Well, I'd like to save as much as we can. The Thornbuckles will be back someday.
Maybe, maybe not. You heard what she said. What if she meant it? Then it's our choice.
If it's my choice, there's things in there I'd like to save.
I don't want war here. I served in the first Patchcock mess, you know.
We know, Gordy.
You don't realize what they can do from space. If we go hide out in the bush, if they don't have time to bring us in, it's a lot safer.
We can't possibly move everything. That house is stuffed with treasures. Art, books, furniture.
And the stables with horses.
Horses can move themselves. House furnishings can't.
People first, then the animals, then things.
Yes, but...
We don't have time for anything else.
Much of the main land mass had been kept a hunting preserve, dotted with small camps and lodges here and there. Every flitter and air car on the planet was pressed into service, moving family groups and neighborhoods out to the remote areas. When everyone who would go had gone, the same flitters and air cars descended on the home village. Already, the staff had prepared what they could of the furnishings, the jewels, the old plate, the oldest and rarest books in the library, the pictures known to be family favorites. The heaviest went down the service lifts into the basement. Maybe it would be enough protection. The rest went into the vehicles to be dispersed as far as possible. Meanwhile, Neil had organized the stable staff, first to move feed and supplies, then horses. The staff tacked up every rideable animal and set off with the others in a long, uneven string across the hay fields and grain fields that spread for kilometers south and east. Almost all the mares had foaled. Neil assigned the lightest riders to the mares, and the foals romped alongside. That group necessarily lagged, as they had to stop for the foals to nurse every hour or so. Lumbering along with them were the village's milk cows and their calves. The sheep and goats skittered along in their own flocks, chivied by excited dogs that had never had this much fun. The foxhounds trotted along in their couples, obedient to the huntsman's horn. The only animals Neil didn't take were those that couldn't travel. It broke his heart to leave them behind. But they would be all right in the home paddocks if the mutineers didn't specifically attack them. He'd left his log, or what looked like his log, in his office, with the comment that he had sprayed for gray lice and evacuated the stable for 60 days. If the attackers believed that, they might not come looking. At least, not if they were in a hurry. Harless had interacted with Fleet only at the highest levels, when, as seated family and younger brother of the speaker, he had been treated with great courtesy. He had gone aboard ships, certainly, ships docked at stations whose crews stood for inspection. He had been impressed with the crisp salutes, the obvious discipline, the spotless cleanliness, the deference accorded superiors. He had imagined himself as another admiral alongside Lupescu, commanding ships in battle, cool, imperturbable. Let Bunny play with politics. He would have real power, he had thought often, remembering the racks of missiles, the orderly arrays of power coils for the beam weapons. Of course, he couldn't actually join Fleet, not with his family responsibilities. But he could befriend admirals and know that he, under his civilian exterior, was at heart a warrior. The reality aboard Gaura Secundus was very different from his earlier brief experiences. Order, discipline, efficiency, yes. The crew, still in Fleet uniforms, with the Familius insignia removed, saluted crisply and moved briskly to their work. But the deference due him, as a family member, as a seat in council, as the brother of the former speaker, that was missing. They were coolly polite. They addressed him as Sir Thornbuckle, but they did not consider him one of them. By the time the Lillian Sea was partway to Millicent, Harless was wondering if he might have made a mistake. When his hirelings bundled him into a pea suit and pushed him through a docking tube from the yacht to their warship, he was uneasily aware that he was alone in a crowd of men and women who had killed before, who enjoyed killing. Who would kill him if he stood in their way? Right now, as the source of funds, he was useful to them.
But what if they decide I'm not useful? Bruno Stepan managed to cut off my access to the banks.
Harless shivered in his little cabin and realized that he did not want to die. He found himself rubbing his ears and yanked his hands down. He had his meals with the officers, with Taylor always at one end of the table and himself at the other. It was here, even more than in the working parts of the ship, that the difference between himself and these men showed up most. He had grown up in a sea of politics, playing at power even as a boy. He'd thought he knew all about it. When he'd pressured old Trima into leaving him her shares, he'd been, he was convinced, as straightforward and pragmatic as any admiral planning a war. He had been held back, he now realized, by his own shrinking flesh. He had not himself gone to Trima's house. He had not himself risked injury or discovery. These people had no such scruples. They were as direct as a blow. The uniformity of their dress, which also excluded him, his best-cut suits looked slovenly next to their uniforms, proclaimed them.
I fear we alarm Sir Thornbuckle.
Alarm me? In what way?
You're looking at us like a deer at a hunter, wondering what's going to happen. The difference between us, Sir Thornbuckle, is that I don't worry about what will happen, because I intend to make it happen, my way.
It's not always that easy.
No, war is not easy, nor is hunting. But it's that or letting the human race degenerate to a lot of parlor ornaments unfit for anything but eating and breeding. Something has to clean the genome, Sir Thornbuckle, and we can't all be registered embryos. But I don't expect much trouble at Cerealis. If you've told us the truth, They have no system defenses worth speaking of, and no defense against armored shuttles. Moreover, the shuttles stored at the three orbital stations will increase our transport capacity.
Unless someone back at Castle Rock thought to tell them we might be on the way.
And who would do that?
It's just possible someone figured it out. My niece, Brunmig, she was just named the Barraclough Sept heir. Stepan chose her. I was going to persuade her to come along. She has all the codes, but she and that disgusting woman from the Lone Star Confederation went out to dinner before we could—
You idiot. You said you weren't a fugitive.
I'm not. I wasn't anyway when I said that, and I don't think I am now. She doesn't know who—
Even if she's too stupid to figure it out, someone will. And you left tracks all over the place, with all systems.
I told them I was going to Burkholt and Celeste.
And you think they'll believe that? After you made a grab for the girl and didn't get her? You lied to me, Thornbuckle. I don't like being lied to.
It wasn't a lie. It was true.
The two officers nearest Harless slid out of their seats and twisted his arms behind him.
I don't like liars, Thornbuckle, and I don't accept excuses. Is that clear? I ask you a question.
Someone grabbed Harless's hair and pulled his head back.
Yes.
Yes what?
I said yes. I'm the one who hired you. Ow! Oh!
A hard punch from behind rammed him into the edge of the table.
You're the one who lied to me. I'm not your servant or your peasant. When you hire troops, you don't lie to them, not if you want to live long. Now, again, is that clear?
Yes. Sir.
The last was wrung out of him by a twist of the arms that made it clear his shoulders would come loose if he didn't say it.
Here's how it's gonna be. You're going to tell me everything you did and planned and thought and heard. Everything. And you're gonna do exactly as you're told by me or by any of these officers. We will continue to treat you well as long as you do not disobey us or lie to us. But withholding information or lying or disobedience will be punished.
Harless nodded, speechless, hoping he wouldn't be made to say yes, sir, again.
Finish your dinner. We'll talk afterwards.
In Taylor's office, Harless tried not to cower like a whipped puppy, but was painfully aware that he was only partially successful.
We need money and we need a secure base. You promised us both, and now you can't deliver.
I can. I have the money. All I have to do is get it. I have the access codes for the family Ansible at Cerealis. That's communication with anyone you want, free. I have the access codes for family accounts, as well as my own. There's information, stuff Bunny's wife had, about family business and things. And the place itself has money.
You sure you have the codes?
Oh, of course I'm sure. Bunny was my brother. I've had the code since I was in my 20s. Look, I know you're worried about pursuit, but is there really any way Fleet could get there before we do?
No.
And even if they do, you could just hide. It's a whole system.
That's why we couldn't. It's too empty. But we could make a fast passage, see if your codes work, get some money, and head out.
You won't need to. I'm telling you, I'm Bunny's brother. Everyone on the planet knows who I am. They're not going to give you any trouble.
Over the course of the next several days, Harless answered hundreds of questions about himself, his family, his fortune, and Cerealis. Taylor recorded all of it. Harless knew how that would look to his family if they got hold of the cube. He'd heard that in story cubes, the hero always managed to find some way of showing that he was being coerced. He couldn't think of anything that Taylor wouldn't recognize and punish. When they arrived at Cerealis, Taylor called him in.
We need the Ansible access code.
Harless handed it over. Taylor handed it on to one of his communications techs.
Strip the records and check our control.
Sure.
The man turned away and fiddled with controls Harless couldn't see.
Someone did think we might come here. It's a voice message from Brune Meager, warning the population Harless might show up, and then that she couldn't get Fleet to respond.
A trap?
Could be. We won't stay that long. We might as well resupply. It's an ag world, with money on it all concentrated in one place, right, Harless?
It still stung that Taylor had quit calling him Sir Thornbuckle, or even Thornbuckle.
Yes, the main banking outlet's in the home village.
Mm-hmm. Just how fancy is that house? Got a lot of things in it? Jewelry those women left behind?
I doubt it. They take it with them, or put it in the bank.
We might just take a look. Admiral Lepescu said this was a show place. Gardens, lawns, stables. You ride, don't you, Harless?
I can, yes. I'm not that fond of it.
Not that fond of it.
Captain, I can't get past the lockout. His password got us into the incoming queue, but there's a trap link on the outgoing. I can't budge it.
That might make it difficult to get your funds, might it, Harless?
Maybe it wants an ID check. Sometimes it does, and I have to go to the terminal.
Well, then I think we'll take a shuttle down and see for ourselves.
Harless felt naked without even a pea suit when the others in the shuttle wore PPUs and armor. Six of them were neuro-enhanced marines, huge and bulky in their battle armor. At their order, he called down to the shuttle field. Someone answered, he didn't know the name, and turned on the field's electronic guidance system. He couldn't see it himself. This shuttle had no windows. The hatch opened, and the scent of Cerealis rushed in, the smell taking him back to a childhood that now seemed very far away. In the midst of them, feeling small and vulnerable, Harless walked across the field, wondering why no one had come to meet them. The men looked this way and that, assessing, cataloging.
Piece of cake.
Find us transport.
But the hangars and shelters were empty. In the office, the only sign of occupation was the main control board, powered up and humming faintly.
They're playing hard to get, are they? Want to hunt?
The other men grinned, too, and nodded.
We'll see. Looks like we have to walk. Where's this bank, Harless?
The village street in early summer looked like a travel poster. The neat stone buildings, the planters full of flowers, more flowers on the vines that clambered here and there. A marmalade cat raised its head from a doorstep, then slid down and into a flower bed between cottages.
Where is everybody? They just run off in the fields?
One of the NEMs kicked open the door to the bank.
Some security.
They herded Harless inside. No one was there, but the autobank was on, just as the shuttle field power had been on. Harless entered his access codes and his credit cube and waited for the light to come on. The autobank transferred the contents of his accounts to the cube. He strained to remember Bunny's code. The bank would lock out for 2 hours if he made a mistake, but his first try worked. Bunny's account balance, however, was zero.
Get your off-world accounts.
Harless entered the complete access codes for financial Ansible transfers and waited.
Ansible access denied. Enter correct code.
They changed the codes. They changed the codes.
He backhanded Harless across the face.
And all you had here was a lousy 200,000?
Taylor jerked his head at the others.
Let's go.
I can get more. I know I can. If...
Shut him up.
One of the NEMs flipped his weapon over and tapped Harless on the shoulder.
Stuff at the house, Captain.
Knick-knacks. Probably all that's left. The sieves have run out like the rabbits they are. They'd have taken the good stuff that was easy to move, unless you'd like some nice sheets and pillowcases.
I'm happy with the ones I have, sir.
Harless looked up the street, where the top stories of the house rose above the trees that edged the gardens.
Want a last look, Harless? Think there's something worthwhile they didn't take away or locked up so you can't get at it?
Pictures, books, tableware, furniture, weapons.
Weapons?
Hunting weapons and old ones, antiques.
Antiques, right. I'm not getting blisters going up there for souvenirs.
Taylor led the way back to the shuttle. Harless looked around, hoping against hope that someone would come to rescue him. There were only 20 mutineers in the landing party. He knew the militia could muster more than that.
Can't they see I'm a prisoner?
No one came, and the NEMs shoved him back aboard the shuttle for its return journey. When they got back aboard, Taylor had two men bring Harless to the bridge.
I think this smug little world needs a lesson, as does Harless here. We're going to break a few windows, knock down a few chimneys.
He looked at Harless.
We'll start with your house, Sir Thornbuckle.
He turned to his weapons officer.
You have the coordinates. Drop one down the middle.
No, don't do that. Why destroy it?
Because I want to. Because I can.
But they didn't do anything to you.
They didn't. You did. You lied to me, and it annoyed me. And when I'm annoyed, sometimes I take it out on things.
But it's mine! It's mine! It always should have been! And besides, it's beautiful!
Not anymore. Show us, Leon.
Up on the screen, the great house appeared, serene and lovely in its encircling gardens and lawns, glowing in the early summer morning light, as beautiful as Harless had ever seen. He could almost smell the roses. Then the missile struck. The house bulged, as if swelling with outrage, and was hidden in a boiling cloud of explosive debris.
Oh, good shot. So much for that one.
The expanding cloud from the first explosion obscured the view of the stable, but not the second billow, the thicker, more boiling cloud. Harless felt sick. His stomach churned. He had never liked horses that much, but he had never wished them harm either. And he could imagine the terrified animals that weren't killed at once, the shattered legs, the blood.
We got what we came for. Now that we have the money...
Lob a few more at him?
No, we might need our weapons for something else. But it makes a statement. Nobody's going to think we're playing a game.
Sir Thornbuckle seems unwell. Smithers, take him to his cabin.
Harless lay staring at the overhead, unable to sleep, his mind running the sequence over and over and over. The house, his house, gone, utterly gone, destroyed. The grand staircase, the ballroom, the fencing salon, the billiard room, the library, the morning room, the sunroom, his own suite with his personal treasures, gone. In a moment of time, a puff of smoke and surge of flame. Horror and grief and fear circled around the memory of what he'd seen. Dread furies that screamed his name.
Bonnie will kill me for this. But Bonnie is dead. So many are dead. So much destruction. How could I? How did I? And what could he do?
His body shivered, long, shuddering quakes, as he remembered the hard hands that had hurt him, the cold eyes that had examined him and found him soft, contemptible, the feral smiles that had delighted in his pain, in his fear, in his horror at their capacity to destroy. Lieutenant Commander Coston stood on the bridge of the RSS Fremantle and grinned at the scan display. A patrol ship, two patrol ships, or something with that mass and drive signature, had just down-jumped into the system.
Well, would you look at that? Were we expecting anything?
His exec, also a lieutenant commander, grinned.
No, sir. Some excitement at last.
Definitely.
At the angle the ships had entered, Scan had picked up their location only 8 light minutes away, with a rapidly lengthening tail aiming toward their entry point as the data streamed in.
Beacon data?
No beacons. Running hot.
And so are we.
Their orders were to prevent mutineers from reaching Athar's world. Futile orders, he'd thought, since space was far too big to barricade. But sure enough, someone had come right past his picket, and the only ships that would run without beacons were those up to no good. He reminded himself that mutiny did not make people stupid, that these ships would know every trick he did. But he had something up his sleeve. Gorgon and Matchless, plus a tactical plan designed for exactly this situation.
If they haven't got a trailing heavy cruiser, they're dead meat.
All signatures confirm fleet patrol craft. No beacon, but everything else, the weapons lit and all that...
Fine, Chris. That just makes it easier.
Coston nodded to his exec.
Put us on the plan. I'll hail them.
The hail was more for the record than anything else. Those could not be innocent merchanters out there, and only the largest private yachts had near that mass. Before his message would have had time to reach the vessels, one of them fired at him.
Good. That makes it simple. No need to wait.
Fremantle micro-jumped. halving the distance to the mutineers, then jumped again to only 5 seconds away. When they came out, the mutineers had fired a salvo at where they'd been. Fremantle micro-jumped ahead to less than a second ahead of the mutineers' computed course. Her own course, warped by the successive micro-jumps, gave only the smallest window for firing down the mutineers' throats. But this was only the first such attack. Fremantle hopped out to be replaced by Gorgon and then Matchless in a precisely timed dance that ensured they didn't hit each other with their weapons. On the screens, hit after hit ablated the mutineers' shields, degraded their ability to fight back. One of the two mutineer ships attempted to break away, micro-jumping 5 minutes out. But at that moment, the first blew, and soon the trio of loyalists had caught and destroyed the other. Costin grinned at his exec.
This'll make the Admiral happy. Now if we can just get some ID on those ships.
Arash Levadi returned to Sector 7 HQ from the first convoy and made his report to Admiral Serrano.
Good work. I'm sure you have ideas now on training for the ships in convoy. I'd like you to brief the captains waiting for the next convoy as soon as you have them organized.
Of course, sir.
Arash explained his observations.
Have you heard the good news?
Haven't heard a thing, sir. Somebody get a mutineer ship back?
Not back, no, but Harris located the mutineer flagship, Bonar Tig, and destroyed it. We have confirmation that Solomon Drizh, he was bumped up to Admiral Minor, just like you, was the actual spearhead.
Levadi's stomach did a slow turn. He had avoided Drizh for years.
Apparently he was one of Lepescu's protégés that we missed, and he'd reconstituted the Loyal Order of Game Hunters.
Admiral Serrano looked sharply at him. Arash felt the sweat slicking the palms of his hands.
You did know about that, didn't you?
Harris told me.
That bastard poisoned everyone he touched. Lepescu, I mean. But apparently Drizh was just as bad.
Levadi swallowed. He had to say it. He had to know what she knew.
I served with Admiral, then Commander Lepescu once, you know. I was pretty young.
I know. You may be the exception to the rule. You're lucky he took a dislike to you. He hated Harris, too. The youngsters he thought had promise...
The youngsters he thought had promise he invited into his circle, flattered them, taught them, urged them to become the elite, the best they could be.
He ruined them.
It's a shame.
If he was still alive, I'd strangle him myself.
Me too.
Levadi meant it. He had been so young, so naive, so willing to be flattered, so honored to be singled out by a commander already known for his dash, his fighting ability, his high standards. He had admired Lepescu, had tried to copy him, even to what he preferred in music and food.
It's amazing how many people one bad apple comes in contact with. And yet there must be others like you who are around him and not part of his coterie. And what we don't need right now is another witch hunt aimed at everyone who served under him, however far back.
I agree.
Harris seems to be doing well with old Indy. How are you getting along with Vigilance?
Fine, sir. Though I'm sure Harris's old crew would like to be with her.
Was this the time to suggest that they could transfer away?
No need to worry about that. Not with a war on. Besides, she's not coming back here. She's over at Copper Mountain, with the debris she picked up. Chances are none of it is a complete personnel list of the mutiny, but the analyst there might find something.
Copper Mountain's ours, then?
For the time being. The bad news is bad indeed. Mutineers hit a battle group over in Sector 5, blew one ship and badly damaged a cruiser. They're trying to blackmail some of the families into hiring them, the old protection racket. There have been sporadic attacks on orbital stations and even planets. We just don't have enough ships to guard everywhere, not and protect the borders. I expect any minute to hear that the Benignity has mounted an invasion. I can't think why they haven't.
Esme Suiza found herself in a crowd of officers heading out to take command of their ships. A couple of lieutenants, like Esme, the rest majors, and one lieutenant commander. Like her, most of them spent hours studying the specs of their new commands. Her ship, the patrol craft Rascal, had been upgraded with new weapons suites that made her almost a mini cruiser. To power this weaponry, she'd been given new drives, and despite all the additions and changes, she was still not overly cramped in her personnel compartments, so she had a full complement of crew. Esme had studied the specs all the way out from Castle Rock until she was sure she could recognize and name everything. Those months she'd spent on Kosciusko learning about hulls and drives made it much easier. She actually understood exactly which modifications supported which of the new additions. Now she was about to see her ship for the first time. She had checked in when she arrived, so if her crew were alert, they'd know she was on the way. And she had taken a few moments in one of the lounges to make sure that her fringe of hair was as neat as it could be. The several weeks of accelerated growth had produced a surprising amount of hair, but it wasn't what she was used to. Up ahead, she saw the docking number and the name Rascal. She squared her shoulders, felt in her pocket one more time for the command wand that would make the ship's electronics accept her as the commander, and approached the smart-looking corporal standing guard at the docking tube hatch. He saw her, recognized the captain's patch on cap and sleeve, and came to attention.
Captain Sweezer! Welcome, sir. Is the captain coming aboard now?
Yes.
Very well, Captain. I've just notified the bridge. We have no officers aboard at present. Master Chief Humberley is in charge. The captain's luggage?
They're sending it when they've unloaded the transport.
Captain Sweezer, welcome.
Master Chief Humberley was a lean, older man whose hair was cropped so short Esme couldn't be sure if he was also balding or not. He had the same brisk, competent, cheerful look as the corporal. Esme liked him at once and noted that he had none of the blurry look that had signaled the older NCOs whose rejuvenation was failing.
I'm sorry Jig Turner isn't aboard. He wanted to meet you, but he was called to the Admiral's office.
That's all right.
Esme already knew that the formalities of coming aboard were minimal for captains below the rank of commander, but Humberley surprised her. He'd turned out the crew in Rascal's rather narrow main corridor, and Esme walked to the bridge to read herself in, feeling very honored indeed. When that was over, and the status board lit with Captain, Esme Sweeza, and Captain aboard, she felt simultaneously fully happy and fully anxious. As on despite, once she was captain, it was all her responsibility, every bit of it. But she'd wanted it. She would make good of it. She turned to Humberley.
What's our readiness, Chief?
Did they tell you about the refit and the upgrades?
Yes. New drives, new weapon suites. I looked them over. We have 34% more firepower, half of it in beam weapons, and the drives to power that without dropping shields. But they didn't say what that did to our micro-jump ability, if anything.
Ah. We haven't tried it. Haven't had the chance. My best guess is that it may knock a few percents off our response time. Not good, but...
Worth the trade, if that's all there is. What about crew? I know that a lot of ships are being crewed with people just thrown together.
We were lucky. Because of the need for training with the upgrades, most of the drives and weapons have been here throughout. We were between captains anyway, and about half the environmental is new. But being as we have such a small complement, we were able to do a bit of weeding.
You went scavenging, didn't you? Good for you.
Patrols don't have much in the way of clerical. Mostly it's the captain's own staff.
He eyed her to see if she knew that already. Esme nodded.
We got a couple of bean counters from supply that haven't been out in a fighting ship before, but they should be all right.
Provisions?
There we've had some problems. Small ship, busy station, and no captain aboard. Jig Turner, he's a fine young officer, you understand, but a Jig just doesn't have the clout of someone more senior, and he's not the type to presume on his position as officer in charge.
How bad is it?
Nothing we can't fix in a few shifts with the captain aboard. I'm sure, sir. Nobody's going to give you that much trouble.
Esme doubted that, but she knew she'd fight back if they did. Her ship wasn't going into action on outdated rations or medical supplies.
What have we got in spareables?
That was the polite term for items used in illicit trade.
Not much. Just a few bits and pieces from the refitting. I was saving some of those back for last-minute problems.
Good idea.
Esme found, to her surprise, that her name and image on the screen worked wonders with supply, which promptly disgorged containers of fresh ration packs whose contents actually matched the lists on the containers. She had a little more trouble with munitions, who tried to insist that patrol craft had no need to stuff themselves with missiles, multiple fusing options, and alternative warheads. Esme finally had to go in person, with copies of the refit details, and argue her way up the chain of command to the Admiral Minor in charge.
If they didn't think we'd see serious fighting, they wouldn't have upgraded the weapons suite. There's no reason to have weapons and no ammunition.
Do you have any idea how much a 347XA warhead costs?
Yes, and I know how much a patrol ship costs and how much the cargo of the next convoy is worth to the mutineers. Do you want them to get that shipload of weapons going out to Sector 8 just because I didn't have the weapons to protect them?
He glared at her, and she glared back. In the back of her mind was the rebellious thought that this was actually fun in its own way. He had to resist, she had to demand. It was like a dance of sorts.
All right. But don't tell the other patrol captains. I'm not giving out everything we have, or there won't be anything to ship to Sector 8.
They don't have our upgrades. Why should I arouse their greed?
Lieutenant, I'm glad you're not any more senior than you are. That was worthy of a Serrano. Which I guess you are now, eh?
I'm not sure they'd agree.
Esme had presented her name to the Admiral's staff, only to be told that for the duration, the normal protocol of paying calls had been suspended. At first, she wondered if this was aimed at her, but it quickly became clear it wasn't.
We've got, what, 4 admirals serving as convoy commanders, and who knows how many ships and captains coming and going. Way too many to hold formal calls. What she's doing is holding a get-together before each convoy leaves. Counts as calls for everyone.
Rascal eased away from the station with permission to proceed to the system's practice sector for 4 days of maneuver practice. Esme, on the bridge, watched as her crew ran through the sequences. No mistakes so far. Behind them, she knew one of the ships, which had just finished its practice, was nosing in for a last bit of supply. Rascal's in-system drives, upgraded to the power of a small cruiser, nudged her out of station space efficiently and made short work of the run out to the first maneuver site. Most patrol class took 18 hours. Rascal made it in 15 and a half. On the same power setting.
Makes me wonder if some of those supply crates are empty.
Esme's executive officer, Jig Turner, had a dry sense of humor she already enjoyed.
Hope not. I was planning on feeding everyone regularly for the next several months.
Up on the main screen came the course they were to match. The first part of maneuver practice was simply designed to ensure that the ships could follow a designated course solo. Then they'd begin to practice in formation. The first day's work went well. Esme's crew knew their business, and Rascal answered the helm neatly once they'd figured out the corrective function for their velocity under the new engines. Esme forced herself to go to bed, but woke up at least once an hour. The next day, they were assigned to microjump practice in the far reaches of the system, light hours from anyone else. Esme found it less nerve-wracking than she expected, with a navigational computer that wasn't shot full of holes, as Despite's had been. Esme could feel the rising morale of the bridge crew as Rascal hit one designated set of coordinates after another. When they had finished the set of 16 jumps and recalibrated all the instruments, she grinned at them.
Well done, people. I don't have to wait for our scores to know we aced that test.
That ship's night, with Rascal on in-system drive working its way back to the area for the next day's formation maneuvers, Esme slept well. Formation maneuvers tested the bridge crew almost as much as microjumping practice. Fleet had not used formal convoys in decades, with the result that no one was familiar with the formations needed. Commodore Admiral Minor Lavati, who would command their convoy, wanted to try out first one, then another formation. Should the escorts be farther away, closer in? Should the patrols be alternated with escorts or bunched together? When they finally finished, and the Commodore still hadn't made up his mind, apparently, and headed back for the station for a final resupply, Esme felt that only one thing was certain. She had a good crew, which was rapidly getting better.